It was probably the late 1950s in Hong Kong, then under British rule. Hong Kong, which the British had acquired through the Opium Wars, wouldn't return to China until July 1st, 1997. In the Chia family home, Gua Min sat nervously beside his father. The family's plan for him, post-Hong Kong, was straightforward. A 9-hour flight to Australia to study agronomy. With their business rooted in seed selling and Australia's agriculture being among the world's most advanced, it made perfect sense. He could almost hear his father's persistent reminder,
"Agronomy. You must study agronomy."
But Gua Min was growing weary of it. Born in 1939, the youngest Chia had become a polyglot by necessity. His education had taken him from Thai in Bangkok's high schools to the Shaozhou dialect back home, then Cantonese in Guangzhou, and now a blend of Cantonese and English in Hong Kong. Despite his efforts in Hong Kong, English was still a struggle, and the thought of starting anew in Australia wasn't appealing. Not one bit. His father glanced up from a letter asking,
"How's your English coming along?"
"It's okay."
"Okay enough for Australia."
Gua Min managed a weak smile, but his father saw right through it.
"You know we need you in agronomy for the family business."
"Right, about that. I've been thinking, maybe I could do something else."
"In Australia?"
I mean, something completely different."
His father turns to give him his full attention.
"Look, our options are limited. Our region's education system just isn't enough, and China is completely off the table."
He was right. China, in the midst of its first 5-year plan, had seized most land and private properties. This move had wiped out the Chia family's fortunes in China, branding their father an enemy overnight. If it weren't for a timely stomach ache that kept him in Hong Kong, Gua Min's father might have been among the million casualties of the revolution. Yet Gua Min's thoughts were elsewhere, haunted by memories of struggling with Chinese in high school, waking at 6 a.m. just to keep up. Sensing his son's internal conflict, Gua Min's father knew this would be a difficult moment. He could force the issue and risk losing his son. As he pondered, it dawned on him. Perhaps there was another option yet to be explored.
"Fine. If you're not going to study agronomy in Australia, you still need to play a part in our family's future. You will have to work."
Gua Min looked up, hopeful.
"You'll be heading back to Bangkok." The decision to send Gua Min back to Bangkok was set to alter his path forever. There, his innate curiosity would lead him to fall in love with a family business and the industry at large. But in the process, teach him the harsh lesson of how swiftly a business division can crumble, taking him down with it. From 1UP Media, this is Empires, episode 2 of a 5-part series, Return to Roots. Danin's return to Charon Pokapand was timely, coinciding with major global shifts. The transformations in China were profound, affecting not just the nation, but also its neighbors, including Thailand. For the Chia family, it would wipe out their operations and wealth in China. With their family fortune in shambles, the focus shifted to Southeast Asia, particularly Thailand. Here, the seeds of Charoen Pokapan, or CP, were sown. Opened as Chiatai in 1921, this humble seed shop flourished, thanks largely to the influx of Chinese farmers. Its prime riverside location added to its appeal, making it an ideal stopover. With time, Chiatai expanded its offerings, introducing a diverse range of seeds. But what truly set it apart was its remarkable customer service. From notifying buyers about seed expiration dates to offering hassle-free trade-ins for outdated stock. In the fiercely competitive environment of Chinatown's business scene, these thoughtful practices resonated deeply with the worried farmers. During World War II, Guomin's uncle took the helm, and under his leadership, the business thrived. They branched out, selling not just seeds, but also fertilizers and pesticides. By the early 1950s, Guomin's elder brothers joined the company, leading to the birth of a feed business named Charoen Pokapan, or CP. You might wonder, why choose a Thai name over a Chinese one? Why not expand Chiatai instead of creating a whole new entity?
Well, Yawarat, Bangkok's Chinatown, was undergoing a transformation. Thailand's monarchy, staunchly anti-communist, found itself ideologically at odds with China. This tension led to tighter immigration controls, and those of Chinese descent in Thailand were encouraged to adopt a Thai name, effectively discarding their political identity. Seeking to align with these changes, the Chia family turned to a Thai general for help in naming their new company. They settled on Charoen, a word signifying prosperity, and Pokapan, which is commonly associated with agriculture and mass-produced goods.
Regarding their personal names, the family's approach was surprisingly simple. It's known that Sumit, their third eldest, was the first to adopt the name Chirewatnon. Following his lead, the rest of the family simply took on the same name soon after. Their casual attitude towards their surname becomes even more apparent in the English translations, leading to a diverse array of spellings. These variations largely depend on when and by whom the translation was done. Today, the most widely recognized version is the one chosen by Guomin, now known to us as Danin.
Interestingly, the name Danin itself was adopted quite spontaneously. He recalls that it was suggested offhand by a civil servant at Thailand's Immigration Bureau.
I didn't know what the name meant, but it sounded good to me, and I liked it.
Returning home with his new identity, Danin was ready to start his new role, from the bottom up, just as his father had warned. In 1959, standing there in the early morning's tranquility, cloth in hand, Danin, the junior assistant, couldn't help but think.
Of course.
Then, with a sense of purpose, he began his primary duty, meticulously wiping the counter.
Thankfully, it didn't take long before his role expanded beyond the basics. From wiping counters, he graduated to handling store finances, managing receipts, and overseeing expenditures. Reflecting back, Danin would come to see this role as foundational, equating it to a practical course in business management.
But from our perspective, much of what he learned in the role came from his own curiosity and eagerness to delve into the unknown. One early morning, before the shop opened, Danin's inquisitive nature led him to join the delivery trucks. This wasn't just any trip. It was a journey to the feed production factory, transporting essential raw materials. The experience was revelatory, giving him a full view of the feed-making process, right from production to distribution. As time progressed, Dannon's involvement in the business deepened. He moved beyond the confines of the shop, playing a key role in the company's distribution chain. Effectively, he was bringing home, or should we say, delivering the bacon.
It was likely the end of the 1950s. The sun beats down on the bustling wharf. Hogs squeal and grunt as workers, drenched in sweat, load them onto the ship. Dannon watches closely at the side, clipboard in hand.
To Dannon, this was a game of high-stakes hog carrying. About 2,000 to 3,000 hogs would be loaded at a single time.
Even today, hog transportation is tough. Close to 700,000 pigs die annually when transported in the U.S. alone. The most common cause is heart failure due to stress.
And Dannon's hogs are on a more dangerous ride than most. From Bangkok all the way to Hong Kong, in the dark, cramped, wind and water battered wharf we call a ferry ride.
For every hog that survived the trip, Dannon would be paid 100 baht. Back then, 300 baht was more than enough to enjoy a luxury meal once he arrived in Hong Kong.
As we mentioned, it was a high-stakes game for him. He approached a dockhand supervisor, a seasoned man with a weathered face.
The way we load these hogs, it's not working. Too many of them don't survive the trip.
The dockhand supervisor barely had the time to reply, but a faint nod seemed to suggest he was listening. Dannon continued.
We need to load them in the middle and rear of the ship, away from the bow, away from the worst of the rocking.
Nothing. Of course. What did he expect? This meant extra work for the supervisors.
I'll pay you 20 baht for each pig that makes it alive.
The supervisor turned, looking at the drove of pigs. Internally, his wheels were churning.
All right, we can try it your way, but it'll mean rearranging a lot of hogs.
Okay, here's 20 baht for you.
Thanks.
Here's 30 for you.
Thank you, boss.
Here's 20, 40, 60.
Years later, Dannon would recall this experience.
All right, that's everything.
Explaining that the greatest lesson he learned wasn't in logistics. Instead, it was in the power of profit sharing. He learned that people are more motivated and work harder if you share the profits with them.
This philosophy proved particularly effective in hog transportation, a task that grew increasingly complex. Despite the challenges, the mortality rate of the hogs remained impressively low. By eventually giving away 50% of his own profits, he incentivized the transport team to take very good care of the hogs, even going as far as devising solutions tailored to the seasonal winds. As Dannon saw his impact in the agriculture industry grow, so did his curiosity to learn, which would lead him to the cooperative. Back in the 1950s, exporting eggs to Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and Macau was a lucrative business. As demand soared, Thailand saw a surge of new merchants eager to tap into this burgeoning market. The poultry industry was on the cusp of a boom, and the Thai government wasn't about to let this opportunity slip by. They stepped in and established a cooperative, centralizing control over egg distribution. This move not only quashed inter-merchant competition, but also ensured a steady flow of tax revenue into government coffers. At the helm of this cooperative was Dr. Chamnan Yuvabun, a law graduate from France and the head of the Interior Ministry's Administration Bureau. Dr. Yuvabun wasted no time in staffing up, filling key positions, including the crucial role of head of exports. Perhaps it was his knack for spotting talent or the pressing need for skilled labor. But Dr. Yuvabun chose an unexpected candidate for the job, Danin Chiriwatnon.
Just weeks earlier, Danin had convinced his family to let him join the cooperative. With their support, he applied and soon found himself sitting across from Dr. Yuvabun. In a direct quotation, Danin explained that the doctor didn't have an extensive interview process. Instead, he looked squarely into Danin's eyes before declaring,
"You show promise. Get to it."
At just 20 years old, Danin was entrusted with significant responsibilities. He was given a private secretary and the mandate to report directly to the board of directors. His first mission? Thailand's poultry industry was teetering on the edge. Every day, over 100,000 birds were being processed, most of them plucked by hand. This reliance on manual labor was a bottleneck, hindering the industry's ability to scale effectively. Simply put, the more chickens there were, the more hands were needed for plucking, and the higher the cost. As a major player in the global market for poultry products, Danin knew the stakes were high, and he braced himself to tackle the challenge head-on.
The initial solution seemed straightforward. Technology. In the technologically advanced realms of the US, Europe, and the rapidly growing Japan, chicken plucking machines had revolutionized the process. These machines worked by dipping chickens in hot water before transferring them to a spinning vat lined with rubber knobs. The friction from the rubber easily stripped the feathers. The team quickly purchased one of these machines from Denmark, only to encounter a new hurdle. Thai chickens varied significantly in size, causing inconsistent feather removal. The machine either required constant adjustment, or some birds would end up partially plucked. In the midst of this dilemma, there emerged a glimmer of hope. Japan might possess the advanced technology they needed, and Danin was promptly dispatched to investigate.
Danin's hopes were somewhat dashed. Despite the superiority of Japanese technology, it fell short in addressing the variability of the Thai chickens. With the clock ticking, Danin took a decisive step. He purchased 16 of these plucking machines from Japan, likely hoping that they could be modified in Thailand. But when the machines were put to use, it became painfully clear that no amount of re-engineering would make them suitable. This investment, rather than yielding returns, turned into a financial burden. Dr. Chamnan Yuvabun, watching the unfolding events with a sense of disappointment, reached a critical conclusion.
Machines alone aren't enough for automated processing. We must make the size of the birds uniform.
But standardizing chicken sizes posed its own challenge. Even within the same species, Thai chickens could differ by as much as 50%. This issue was pressing, but Danin and the cooperative soon found themselves facing an even larger problem. Poultry exports from China had gone rogue.
After the Chinese Civil War, the Soviet Union became a powerful ally. The outflow of assistance was vast and relentless, including very generous loan terms to China. However, after 1953, their relationship changed. Nikita Khrushchev, ascending to power in the USSR, advocated a more moderate stance on communism. This approach didn't sit well with Mao Zedong, leading him to view Khrushchev with growing mistrust. Their ideological debates eventually withered ties, culminating in the severance of the USSR's generosity. Subsequently, Russia started pressing for the swift repayment of its loans to China. Faced with this financial strain, China turned to selling what it had in abundance: agricultural products, including eggs. They immediately redirected all shipments to the USSR, leading to a huge egg shortage in Hong Kong,
a market that Thailand's cooperative traded with heavily. Despite their best efforts, they couldn't compensate for the sudden deficit, and Hong Kong plunged into an egg crisis.
News of the disaster swiftly reached China, prompting them to redirect their exports once again to Hong Kong. But in their haste to rectify the situation, they oversupplied the market, leading to a flood of pork and eggs, collapsing prices.
Thailand found itself unable to export to Hong Kong profitably, and the cooperative started incurring losses. Now, survival options were limited. They could either hope for China to shift its focus back to the USSR or drastically reduce costs to restore profitability. As Dannon and his team sought new strategies, the cooperative's financial reserves dwindled. The machinery, unable to adjust to the varying sizes of the chickens, failed to improve efficiency. Each farm's unique processes and the varying sizes of chickens bred continued to require manual labor. By 1964, the cooperative had exhausted its funding, and the Thai government dissolved the cooperative. At the age of 25, Dannon lost his job, and with his wife of 2 years, returned back to Sipi, scarred.
In the 5 years Dannon was away, Charon Pokapand, the family's feed business, had blossomed remarkably. By tuning in to the farmers' needs, they had unleashed a dynamic flywheel approach to growth.
At its heart, the strategy was straightforward. Animal feed primarily consists of grains, which are grown from seeds. This fact established a mutually beneficial relationship between CP seed and feed sectors. The farmers, who began as seed purchasers from CP, gradually became key suppliers for CP's feed division.
These farmers, in turn, reinvested their earnings back into their farms, leading to larger farms, higher yields, and in turn, more demand and supply for CP. This virtuous cycle propelled CP's feed division to new heights. By 1964, they had become Thailand's largest feed company, supporting about 200 Thai employees.
At the head was Dannon's second eldest brother, Montri, who was both president and manager of the feed business. But Montri was more of an innovator at heart and preferred to discover new products. At the side, he was already experimenting with mung beans, corn, and soybeans, and even producing bags to carry grain. The collapse of the cooperative, though a setback, brought Dannon back to CP and opened a significant opportunity for the family. It allowed Montri to hand over the presidency to Dannon, paving the way for each brother to focus on their respective strengths.
For Dannon, this return to his roots likely signified a profound shift in perspective, where once he followed his curiosity without restraint, he now adopted a more measured approach. He realized the importance of cautious curiosity in an unpredictable market. Dannon would later articulate this philosophy at CP, preferring decisions with favorable odds. He termed it the 70-30 rule, a strategy prioritizing the delicate balance between success and risk. Under this rule, any venture with a potential for bankruptcy is immediately ruled out.
Wow.
As the late 1960s began to unfold, Danin, now at the helm of CP Feeds, found himself on the cusp of groundbreaking opportunities. Among the array of calculated risks he could take, one particular decision stood out. It was a daring move that, if successful, had the potential to transform CP into the kitchen of the world. From 1UP Media, this is Empires, episode 2 of a 5-part series, Return to Roots. Next on Empires, Danin sets out to solve what the cooperative failed to do, and in turn, transform CP to become the kitchen of the world. Follow us so you won't miss out on episode 3 of our 5-part series, The Kitchen of the World. Empires is a 1UP Media original, produced and written by Guang Jin, edited by Alex, audio experience by Ethan Sam, additional engineering by Ashley from 1UP Media, and narrated by Luis Cruz and Claire Bernal. International research by Sonia, Kuyet, and Jiamin from 1UP Media. A quick word on our reenactments and dramatizations. While we can't know exactly what they say, think, or feel at the moment, it is all based on research. Thank you for listening.